Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, here we are in spring. Spring has sprung. Well, it's just rainy here today, so I guess that's part of spring. I guess they say April showers bring May flowers, but I guess late March showers bring May flowers as well. Close enough. Well, this week's a couple of events. I think we agreed to talk about the landmark decision, Brown versus Board of Education. It's 70 years old now. We can talk about its impact, the cult of integration, sort of the I guess you could say the hidden grammar to that decision, and the and its consequences. But before that, we did have a development for months now, at least since October 7th. There's been a feud between the black conservative female hostess. Or Candace Owens and her employer, Daily Wire, particularly Ben Shapiro. Since the October 7th raid, she had been particularly critical of Israel and, I guess, indirectly of Jews, American Jews, and their influence in American politics, particularly kind of implicating the United States in the ongoing ethnic cleansing in Palestine. October 7th, of course, being the pretext for the current ethnic cleansing operation that we're all witnessing. And the U.S., of course, is lavished Israel with support, not surprisingly, because AIPAC controls the U.S. Congress and our government is controlled by largely controlled by Jewish interests. And she was kind of hinting at that. Apparently, she was bought out. They paid the remainder of her contract, which I thought they couldn't fire because she hadn't broken any terms. So apparently, she had a pretty tight contract with them. Kudos to for Candace for that. They had to buy her off, send her on her way. Now she is free. Free at last, free at last. She sent out a tweet explaining, "My crime is that I do not believe that American taxpayers should have to pay for Israel's wars or the wars of any other country. I will not change my mind. So the question is, what will you do to me next? The world is watching." She also interviewed this rabbi. Did you see that by any chance?
I did not.
Okay, if you get a chance, see it, if you can find it. Rabbi Barclay is an older rabbi, and he was lecturing her and explaining what anti-Semitism is and how it's always changing, and she wouldn't let him do that. He came off very poorly, and she outsmarted him. It's a very revealing and entertaining interview because it's so condescending, but he really shows his hand, betrays the true nature. She wouldn't let him do. He says he can redefine anti-Semitism. It mutates apparently, so therefore there's no definition. That's very convenient for him, isn't it? Because you can just change the definition and just whoever's in your way or presenting in opposition to your agenda, you can just call them anti-Semite, redefine it, and they're an anti-Semite. And lo and behold, Candace Owens became an anti-Semite. One thing is, she came to defense of Kanye West last year during his run-in with the tribe, and then she on her show. And this is another thing you should watch, is she talked about right after she came to Kanye's defense last year, she was invited to the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And she had a meeting, but she didn't meet anybody. All she did was sit in a room, and some old rabbis came to the room and started talking Hebrew. She didn't know what they're saying, and they told her that she had made a mistake, but they're willing to look past it if she behaves from now on to continue doing what she is doing. And the continue to do she was doing is sort of do the Daily Wire thing where she condemns leftism, some of the degeneracy like abortion, some of the cultural politics, but never mentioned the Jews. And she had a meeting with what clearly was sort of like a Sanhedrin. And so, I mean, it's an odd, she gets this very odd meeting. And you're watching her describe, she's somewhat perplexed about it, but she was kind of shown how to behave. She says, behave and, stay on the chain. It's a golden chain, but you're being paid well. But nevertheless, she's been fired. And like I said, she's a conservative. Daily Wire is supposedly conservative. So why is she being fired? She was fired because she criticized Israel and indirectly Jewish power in the United States. So it kind of exposes the whole scam there.
Yeah, and it's just becoming more and more difficult for them to keep a coherent narrative as far as why they aren't establishing a slave state, because all of the ways that they control in terms of their moral basis, the Holocaust or the eternal victim, these things are just no longer coherent. And so all that's left is just power. And that woman is just experiencing it. And when she, I was interested in the fact that in the discussion with the rabbi who, you know, saw a ever-changing definition of anti-Semitism, that she was easily victorious in terms of, you know, the mental skirmish. And I think it's almost impossible not to win if you're not intimidated, because if you simply ask the honest and obvious questions about, you know, the other person's positions, they dissemble. I mean, that individual, that rabbi, he wouldn't even have the capacity to give kind of an overview using logic and kind of a train of thought in terms of why, you know, anti-Semitism was dangerous, or what it was, or how it had to be controlled. I mean, he's almost as manipulated as the Gentiles are, you know? I mean, he's just an automaton, because anyone who's thinking, clear-minded, his brain is still functioning, can see what's going on. It's as clear as a bell. The anti-Semitism is just being used for power at this point. It's one of the memes which are terms that stop people from thinking. You know, racism, anti-Semitism, Holocaust denier, truther. These are terms which really can't stand any scrutiny. They just can't, because they're designed to intimidate. And if you are in the process of scrutinizing them, the intimidation falls away, and they're left exposed as just being levers of power. You know, that's all they are. They're just there to dominate.
Yep. And I saw Candace Owens now fundraising, making appeals to support. Apparently her buyout was a remainder of her $10 million contract. So I don't think she's hurting. She's also married to a rather wealthy individual. I think his family has ties to like rare metal wealth or gold or silver. I don't know, worth like $100 million. So she's not hurting. So I don't know why she's fundraising, but that's probably just the American way, I suppose, the business. And she's going to start her own thing, I guess, I suppose. So if you are an attractive, articulate, conservative, Black Christian female, there is a spot at the Daily Wire for you. Just don't mention the Jews.
That's right.
So there you go. There's an ad somewhere. There like you go.
Chappelle, when Chappelle was making, you know, after Kanye West situation, he was making jokes. Chappelle's making jokes about how we can't talk about this. Mm-hmm. You know, why can't we talk about this? Isn't this something to talk about? Isn't this a, you know, a category of reality? And for a while, it really, you know, it caught on. People were sort of abuzz about that. I think it's going to happen more and more. I really honestly think the whole kind of apparatus of Gentile control through the intimidation and, the way that the terms are used, like anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. Holocaust denier, I think this is just falling by the boards at this point. I'm finding more and more people that are actually able to talk about it. I think the media now has to avoid it completely.
Oh, yes. The media says she was fired for anti-Semitic remarks. Now, that was the dispute.
Exactly, yeah.
Her claim is, now this is an issue of terminology. As they define anti-Semitism, it is anti-Semitic, because their definition is simply criticism on a norm for Jews.
Well, moreover, it's always moving.
It's
like a referent that basically encompasses the entire universe. So everything can be anti-Semitism when they want it to be. But you see, this is just stupid. I can't believe that that this will go on a lot longer. You know, the one thing that's very interesting is the statistics on how many people are now skeptical about the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's up from like zero, you know, in 1950 to, you know, like I've seen some like 25-30%. So you can see that
I think it's higher with people who are younger too. So
yes, that's right. And yeah. And so the thing is that this is so the trend is obvious, and you can't really hide the truth about the purported Holocaust, I think, from the youth at this point. You know, the internet just permits too many ways to research it, and you know, again, Rudolph's encyclopedia is just overwhelming and definitive. And so, you know, I think it'll, this will spread out, and they're going to have to go to other maybe chemical methods of mind control. You know, you, like I've been reading about how the AI, as it takes over the internet, might be used as a constant form of mind control, you know.
Mm-hmm. And,
but again, I'm very skeptical of these things.
Well, they've tried that with Google, right, with the manipulation of the algorithm.
Google is actually part of it. And you can see Google, you know, wanting to rewrite history and turn all of the
Remember on YouTube when they start doing the disclaimer, if you're talking about anything controversial, they automatically put the official, like, Wikipedia version of the controversy underneath.
Right, I know. And I think that this...
Does that do any good? I mean, who actually... Oh.
Tim, it's diminishing returns.
Here's the official lie.
Right. They do that, and that just, you know, kind of creates more skepticism. It doesn't dampen it down. It's so they're really not able to control it much longer. They're going to have to switch gears to more draconian. I mean, the vaccine, you know, perhaps with the, you know, ways to dumb us down or take away our emotions, or, you know, who knows what kind of modern human they might try to create. But I think the intellectual side, the side that kind of, you know, goes from the authoritarian personality to, you know, present moment, I think that's just in collapse at this point. And we can look forward to just more and more freedom of information, because the internet is, you know, they're obviously trying to control and have done a very good job of it, but, you know, there are so many cracks within it and ways to get around it, and people now are skeptical, and so they're looking for the information.
When did the YouTube crackdown begin? Or internet? It was like 2017, 18, 16?
Yeah.
Right with the election of Donald Trump, right? Well, obviously, if you look at the polling and the information, just the general tone or trends I see, there's greater skepticism than wasn't since the crackdown. So it has
a good example. Yeah. They can't even slow it down at this point. I really think that, I mean, look at the response to the Gaza invasion.
Mm-hmm.
I think a majority of Americans are very skeptical about the pretext that Israel gave. Majority, I would say, not a large majority, but I would think 60% of the public were very skeptical about it. Not to say they would have strong understanding of the truth, but they didn't buy it. There was, you know, problems with it. And
well, then the whole world was forced to witness the slaughter of anywhere from 30,000 to a couple hundred thousand Palestinians, 90% of whom are civilians. And then we're told the biggest problem in the world is anti-Semitism.
Right. No, So it's it's just a kind of, it's just intellectual domination that depends upon intimidation. And if intimidation transforms into skepticism, the whole thing falls apart because the arguments are too stupid to really convince anyone. And the evil is too obvious, you know?
Yeah. They can't engage Candace Owens on these matters. They should shut her down. I mean, it's like, don't even broach the topic. Well, what? And it's insulting everyone's intelligence. And that's the problem.
Well, and also even here,
I thought they were smarter than everybody else.
Right. If they and more honest, you know, if they had honest arguments and honest facts, they could engage her. The problem is they don't. They don't have any. It's just a pack of lies.
Yeah, and high verbal IQ doesn't compensate for lying.
Right. So the problem is they can't talk to someone like this.
This guy Barkley, this Rabbi Barkley, actually said to Candace Owens that October 7th was the worst day in human history. Or in Jewish history. Like, what are you talking about? I was like, how about all the days proceeding on in Gaza? It's been far worse. Or any other, I don't know. How about like August 6th, 1945? Or February 20th, 1945, when they bombed Dresden?
Where my grandfather was mustard gas and 60,000 people died in an afternoon.
Yeah, the 1916.
Yeah, 1917. And so the thing
what are you talking about?
The thing is that the statement itself reveals a kind of self-centeredness, a myopia, a vanity of and a racism, right?
Yes.
Just a profound racism where other human experiences are irrelevant.
But your suffering is worse than everyone else's suffering. It's more valuable. And you know, it's better that, you know, that 100 million goyim die than one Jew die. And he revealed himself in that. That was what he was saying.
Sure. And if you pointed this out to him, he'd go, well, don't forget the Holocaust, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the fact is we haven't forgotten it. In fact, we're now studying it. And you know what? It doesn't stand scrutiny.
Yeah, you told me it's the most documented. I'm looking at the documents, or lack thereof.
Yeah, the problem for them is that it is fairly well documented, and the documents all reveal that there was no gas chamber extermination program, and that the reason why there is no forensic evidence, like for example bodies, is because there aren't any, weren't any. So you know, good luck trying to maintain the Holocaust narrative going forward. I think it's going to be interesting to see how it falls apart, because I mean, it could be quite profound. In other words, it could, if it starts really to just collapse, and people are starting to speak publicly in the media about how the Holocaust was propaganda, well, this could turn into, instead of being intimidated and you know, sort of sympathetic toward Jews, into rage. You see, this is the problem when you lie. This is the big problem, is that you might get away with it, but if you don't, things get worse, you see, than if you've just been honest. And so this, you know, the capacity to intimidate and to lie your way out of it, I just think that there's too many independent sources of information. I mean, in 1950, it was literally zero. I mean, nothing. There was just, everything was believed. The CNN could just, I mean, excuse me, CBS could just give you information, and it was, you know, like, it was like reality itself. Mm-hmm. But now almost no one believes their sources of information, and almost everyone is skeptical, kind of becoming more and more aware about propaganda. And so, yeah, the future is bright for the Gentile, that is.
Well, this year, 1954, we could talk about the landmark decision, Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. It was a decision handed down in 1954, a landmark decision where the Supreme Court ruled that separating children in public schools on the basis of race was unconstitutional. It signaled the end of legalized racial segregation in schools of the United States, overruling the separate but equal principle set forth in the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson case. It didn't declare that separate but equal was unconstitutional. It declared that separate but equal was impossible, meaning separation was inherently unequal, therefore you couldn't have separate but equal. I believe that was sort of the nuanced explanation, because they didn't want to directly overrule the decision following the principle of stare decisis. On May 17th, 1954, the Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren delivered the unanimous ruling, 9-0, and the landmark case, the historic decision marked the end of separate but equal. Yeah, I already said that. Just 1 year later, in 1955, Earl Warren read the court's unanimous decision, now referred to as Brown 2, instructing the states to begin desegregation plans with all deliberate speed. So there were desegregation plans that were demanded. This kind of lingered for a while, particularly in the South. Busing in the following decade, late 60s, early 70s, began because of this decision. Now, despite the unanimous decisions, the vague wording, there was a considerable resistance to the ruling initially in Brown versus Board of Education. In the South, of course, there was a lot of resistance to it. There's a lot of showdown. I think it was the 82nd Airborne was flown in at Bannett Point to integrate one public high school. So that was in the name of democracy. So whites were being poked with bayonets to submit to the ruling itself. There is some criticism. Supporters of judicial restraint believe the court had overstepped its constitutional powers by essentially writing new law, which it did. We can discuss that, how there was no legal reasoning in the case. I think the decision itself was like as long as a short newspaper article. It doesn't really lend itself, or at least give us the idea that there was a, you know, like legal scholarship to this decision. There was some reference to the 14th Amendment, but then again, that again, there was no legal argument. It was more sociological, based on tests, dubious test results involving dolls and inferiority and self-esteem, and it just had to be done. I think that's what it was said. It was Felix Frankfurter said the decision had to be made despite the law, which then again, despite being a Supreme Court justice and a judge, it's not really his role or his power to do that any more than I have the power to do that. I think something should be done. Therefore, you know, should I put on a robe and claim that I'm a judge and just change the law? You know, there's legislative remedies for these such things, which would have been the proper way to go about doing these things. Nevertheless, supporters of it said it was good because it addressed this long issue of race in America between black and white. and it was a step forward in race relations and progress, you know, for Blacks in America. Again, the idea that you could just overturn the, you know, impose these rulings on a country, on society, and a culture, and not expect unintended consequences is sort of, looking back at it, is kind of naive and silly. But then again, I don't think they cared. So that was Brown versus Board of Education. Of course, this sort of sparked the civil rights movement. And 10 years later, you get the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, Hart-Celler, and then we were off to the races, and that's where we are today. And of course, this also created a cottage industry for racial discrimination litigation, law itself. A lot of alphabet soup agencies sprung up to enforce the law, to monitor it. This the logic of civil rights law also created in many people's minds inevitably affirmative action or reverse discrimination, even despite promises that it wouldn't do that. I believe even the during the debates over Brown versus Education, there were people critical of it. People said this would not create busing. Of course, within 10 years, busing was national throughout the country. Same with affirmative action. Promised it wouldn't do this, and it did it. But then again, no one looks back and go, oh, you were right. You can't do that when you're dealing with progress. Always look forward, even if you're headed towards a cliff. You got to march forward. You got to be progressive about these things. So that's Brown versus Board of Education. So what say you?
Well, I mean, integration is really, kind of the underlying goal of Brown versus Board of Education. I mean, they're trying to integrate African-Americans and European-Americans. This is what the purpose is. And the idea was, at least as it was presented, was that the poor performance of African-Americans, in academics was the result of different environments. And that if the environment was equal, there would be a dramatic leveling of outcome. That was the idea. And in back of that was an idea that then became popular a little later on, but it was used to kind of prop it up and to justify it, which is that all humans are 99% the same in terms of their DNA. So therefore, since we're so identical, any profound difference in terms of behavioral outcome must be related to environment. So this was the what was told to us, and in fact it's completely untrue. And the actual truth is now, like in many areas, starting to slip out. And I have no idea how this discussion is ever going to be had in America openly and honestly, but here is the problem. The problem is that Europeans and Chinese have DNA from Neanderthal between 3 and 7%. So it's considerable. And some of these genes are brain active. So they could be affecting differences in brain function. Okay, so that was discovered after the human genome was brought to the public's attention. And
so there are cognitive differences between the races.
Absolutely. Well, there are cognitive genetic differences. Now, this is because there is differences in terms of the manufacturing of the proteins for the brain. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there has to be differences in the brain, which have to imply, or at least naturally imply, that there's differences in some kind of differences in the cognitive functions. Okay, now that was swallowed. It didn't really cause much of a problem. But then more recently, then just an absolute collapse of the theory of the similarity, genetic similarity, occurred when they discovered the ghost species that was part of the genetic material for Sub-Saharan Africans, particularly West Africans. I mean, when you say Sub-Saharan, because the Nile is such a conduit of genetic material, all of the people who have access to the Nile have more complex genetic backgrounds, because there's so much gene sharing that goes along.
Well, this is nature of commerce and intercourse.
Yeah, commerce,
both commercial and
so the Ethiopians, they have there's a lot of gene sharing. But West Africa, where in fact most of American African American come from, because this is where the slaves were captured. That group has as part of its genetic makeup a between like 3 and 20%. They average it at 10 or 11%, and when they talk about it, if they ever do talk about it, from a species that was not shared with the Europeans. It's completely different. And so they know it came from a from a form of Homo sapiens that did not basically insert genetic material up the Nile. And they don't have any, or at least they claim not to have any physical remnants, skulls or things like this. However, it's because they can tell from just the nature of the genes, they know it's very ancient, that this individual, this, this genetic insertion is from a very old species. It is prior to the where the genes in Homo sapiens come from. And so they now this is so clear. They've done so. They at first they resisted it. Then the geneticists said, no, it's just impossible to ignore. And they are now having the general theory. If you go to Google, you'll see that they'll say that the ghost species was probably Homo erectus, which was the precursor to Homo sapiens. Now you can see how they haven't really, at least I haven't been able to find where they've divulged, what were the genes that Homo erectus, if that was the ghost species. And this incidentally is almost self-evident because there's really no other species that could have been, right? The only archaic kind of pre-human to Homo sapiens that they have in the area they know about is Homo erectus. And Homo erectus would have been the species that left Africa over a million years ago and then eventually evolved into Neanderthal. Anyway, I know we're getting kind of off the subject here, but my point is that you have too much genetic material that's different now to have integration sort of occur without taking steps to understand and to basically ameliorate any kind of negative differences that could exist, right? So, and this is, this, as I said, it's a discussion that's almost unimaginable to occur in American media. But the fact is, there are probably really profound differences in terms of cognitive capacities between Cro-Magnon, which is, Asian and European species, the Homo sapiens, and Sub-Saharan Africa, which has 10% of its genetic material from this other animal, other species of human. So there you have it, Tim. When they began integration, the idea was that, well, it's the differences, the cognitive outcome differences will disappear if you give them the same environment. And okay, of course, haven't. And of course, if you look at the Baltimore School District, which, by the way, is completely segregated at this point, mm-hmm. because the Great Society program and combined with busing has led to an absolute collapse of the educational system that the African-American children in the inner cities are getting, right?
Yeah, well, virtually every school district engaged in busing, busing in the 70s, ended up actually more segregated after because of the phenomenon of white flight.
Well, sure, because and you can see that people were saying, well, it's racist, right? They left because of racism. And the basis of that argument was that if they would just stay, the differences, the cognitive and behavioral differences will just disappear and everything will be this workers' paradise situation, right, of integration. But that doesn't happen, and you get really strong differences in cognitive outcomes and also behavioral outcomes, right? Because mm-hmm. there's no who's to say that with so much difference between Neanderthal and Homo erectus, since that I think is the best way to characterize these unique genes that the Sub-Saharan African and shares that does not share with with the North. You just don't have any way that the current framework is gonna not screw this all up, make it much worse, because clearly there should be some really intensive analysis of this made public. You can see how just critical that is. Everyone in Europe that now is being basically led into this race mixing situation, right? Everyone should be made aware of this, because they should know what the outcome for their children and grandchildren are going to be. And moreover, so that's on the behavioral side. On the cognitive side, if there are these differences, then there might be the need for different kinds of educational pedagogy, right? I mean, it's perfectly natural to think that they might need a different kind of way of being educated, because there might be just differences, and we don't even know at this point what the differences are. And this is the thing, is that no one wants to look into this, because it's very hard for geneticists to even write papers about this. If you read the papers that approach a subject, Tim, you'll see that it's almost like people talking about the vaccine who are in the pharmaceutical sciences. They just have to use sophistry everywhere in order to get their information across, because they can't speak about the stuff honestly. Well, here we have the same situation here. You have the ghost species, probably Homo erectus, very likely. And then you have the cognitive capacity of Neanderthal. Okay, no one would ever claim that Homo erectus and Neanderthal should be integrated into some kind of pedagogy, because it's just obvious, right, that they are different. However, Europeans and sub-Saharan Africans share, I mean, they possess the difference as well. We are in a situation genetically now that we cannot honestly understand ourselves, and we cannot honestly create pedagogy for either group, because we're trying to do this integration approach, even though the basis of it, the 99% similar DNA, is now not even believed in by any geneticists on the planet. So there we are. The irrationality continues, and the truth continues to be suppressed. But it would be just like with all the other things in the paradigm of domination, that keeps Europeans from thinking clearly. This would be a great thing to have break down and have people really start to study it and expose it and try to move this science forward to the point where we would be able to say, okay, just looking at the profile of this individual and some kind of gene test, we have pedagogical approaches that will give this person the best possible result. And I tell you, it isn't going to be integration and busing. Those will not show up on the list. How are we going to make things better for these children?
Well, if there are indeed significant cognitive differences genetically between the races, and evidence suggests that there is, at a pedestrian level, these individuals that are forced to cope with this, being everyday Americans, shouldn't be forced to be guinea pigs in the social engineers' experimentation with this.
Yeah.
They have interest too, and regardless of this is like outcomes based jurisprudence and social engineering, where people are subject to these experiments and they shouldn't be. What you're saying is that given these differences in cognitive abilities, however narrow or wide, will produce differences in attitude and cultures, which affect everyone's life day to day on the street or in school. For example, your daughter getting raped at school, or your son's getting beaten up by black gangs, which was what happened after they integrated the schools. They sent in a bunch of black youths into these schools, and the schools immediately declined, especially as the whites escaped. They could find, they could retreat 20, 30 miles away into the suburbs. And that's what happened. So, but there are, again, which is now whatever different, like I said, we have a system of government, we have equal protection of the law, the 14th Amendment. Now, again, this is a gross misinterpretation of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment itself is problematic because it wasn't passed constitutionally. We had a show about that a few months ago, about the problems of the 14th
Yeah.
Amendment. Nevertheless, it was relatively, I guess, narrow in scope, or at least what it sought to do. It didn't seek to make impose full equality on the country. That simply would have been accepted at the time. People who wrote the 14th Amendment didn't think there was broad-based equality. They knew there were differences. But what it did do is to establish certain procedural rights, meaning how you interact with the government. It didn't mean that all expression or incidents of inequality in society had to be addressed or was a violation of the 14th Amendment. This is where substantive due process comes into play. And substantive due process is an invitation for social engineering. Because in a free society, particularly a diverse society that becomes less homogeneous, you're going to have diversity in outcome and inequality. It's a question of what's the source of the inequality. There are legitimate reasons for inequality, and maybe there are illegitimate reasons for inequality, like having privilege, access to theft, or political entrepreneurship and subsidy and all that. But there's also differences in ability, as you alluded to, and there's also differences in culture. The best thing to do is to let those people separate as they wish. Now, the problem you had with the Brown decision was it said segregation was wrong. Segregation doesn't necessarily imply integration. Integration is a positive act. People tended to live separately, ethnic groups tended to live amongst themselves because of socioeconomic conditions and also because of in-group preferences. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, nor unconstitutional about that. But with Brown versus Board of Education, it became sort of canon and law. It's become sacred. It's canonical in law. Everything in law has to be subsumed to the interest of Brown, which is integration. Therefore, any expression that doesn't promote integration is counter to Brown, and the government has to step in and force people to integrate. That's the problem. One of the problems. That's why you had the forced busing almost immediately, or at least in the ensuing decades, rather, with us. We had this, you know, people were willing to bust hours across town so you can meet some judge's idea of racial balance. Usually this judge's children didn't attend those schools, by the way. Usually they were at private schools. They didn't have to deal with that. It also, Brown also created some, also the Civil Rights Act did this too. It expanded the idea of state action, meaning that there was no private sphere anymore. Even there were critics of that. I think there was Harold Wechsler, who was a law professor at the time, who said this was a kind of totalitarian because it does away with the private sphere. It did away with voluntary contract. Not directly, it eventually did. The Civil Rights Act did that too. When it made illegal private discrimination under the pretext of commerce, the Commerce Clause, I believe. But it state action, where state action could apply to anyone involved in any commerce. And so then it became sort of I think Hannah Arendt actually talked about this too. This can be very, this can be construed as it has been to destroy all legitimate private spheres. In the past, it was considered acceptable that people to engage in private discrimination. Again, this is a pretext for mass social engineering and the destruction of ethnic identity, as we see, particularly targeted ethnic identity like ethnic whites in America, which. And it's interesting to say that the Brown case itself was a product of barity, meaning it was sort of weaponized law, which is usually considered wasn't considered acceptable, if not illegal, where you take the judicial legal process for a political reason. This was a setup case, and it was funded by the Garland Fund, which is a Jewish foundation, and it was mostly decided by and also prosecuted, at least litigated by Jews. And you could say that the Brown decision was an extension and continuation of the Jewish war on the South, which began in the wake of the Leo Frank case. And this is when they started weaponizing. It's when they started the NAACP. It was always set up by Jews. It was there to sort of agitate and sort of use the Black issue, the Black question, to create problems, particularly in the South, but eventually throughout the country. One thing is they opposed Black nationalism, and they wanted to support integration because ultimately they wanted to do away with America's ethnic identity to make it weaker, and you know, diversity is our strength, that whole Jewish
exactly.
agenda.
You know? Exactly. That was the thing.
Yeah. And yeah, so,
they wanted to use integration in a malevolent way. And this is, again, yeah, it's just like this dark secret that can't be discussed. But the fact is, if you look at all of the details and all the associating kind of things that were surrounding it, you can see it was a thrust against European ethnic neighborhoods, mm-hmm. European ethnic political power. And it was basically a Judeo-Masonic project to...
It was the WASP Jewish Alliance that initially did. The Ford Foundation, coupled with the American
the
Jewish
WASP,
Committee.
And the WASP were, you know, Freemasons in many cases. Yeah. So you had this combination that was designed and, you know, they were interested in destroying Christian culture and power, political power in the United States. And so this malevolence in back of the decisions and in back of the design of the social policies has never been discussed.
What it does is it makes an anti-racist constitution, which means that all under interests, all other issues in the constitution have to be subordinated to the interest of race.
Yeah.
So if anything, so basically your private sphere to run your business, in-group preference, private life, if it can anyway be construed as being racist or separatist, it has to be destroyed. That's what Brown
did. Exactly. And then, of course, then in critical theory, you have to continue to attack Christian culture until it is basically evaporated. And so therefore you would expand the power of civil rights to things like transgenders.
Well, that's right. What happened. Glad you mentioned
right.
That.
Our civil right. You know, I mean,
yeah. Do you remember the Colorado case, the Baker, the gay couple?
You wouldn't do the cake. Yeah.
In the arguments in the court, you can with Kagan, and you can see it in the courts. They asked the defendant lawyer has said, well, what if your argument says that he shouldn't have to bake a cake against his conscience, and in the argument they go, what if he didn't want to bake a cake for a mixed race couple that was getting married?
Yes, exactly.
See the reasoning there? And
yeah,
they there couldn't, what's the difference?
Yeah.
But the argument the lawyer goes is because the government has a compelling interest in fighting racism. And when you have a compelling interest in fighting racism, what you're saying, what that really is it's not racism is just a code for anti-white. Because we all know that minority groups like blacks aren't held to the same standard. They're allowed to have group identity. They're allowed to have black organizations, student organizations. They're considered a protective class, whereas ethnic whites aren't given an identity. Blacks are.
It's just a sophistry by which dictatorship hides. I mean, it's like the government has an invested interest in fighting anti-Semitism, really. So how is this defined?
There you go. Define it.
Now, because what it ends up with is that basically as long as there is any, sort of proponents of Christian culture, then the government has a continuing, requirement to continue destroying it, right? Because it has the potential or in fact is anti-Semitic because there's natural conflicts between ethnicities and religion. So they've just got this very clever, intellectual political structure set up whereby they can dominate and then, point to these platitudes, these political platitudes as their rationale. But even
where schools had actually equal, initially they said that separate equal didn't work because black schools were funded much less than white schools in the South, generally speaking. Well, the South came back and these other states said, well, schools are all locally funded and blacks were poor. That was their excuse. But then even in states where they equalized the funding, the courts required that they integrate. So it was a bad faith argument.
Right. And of course, it was one that in terms of the goal, which was to create educational equality of outcome, it was just failing from the very beginning.
Well, as you alluded to, you might be going against something as fundamental as the biology. I mean, my point is...
Exactly. And this goes back to the genetic problems because...
The presumption of equality all across the board is a presumption. There's no evidence for it, is there?
No, I mean, the legal principle that the critical theory guys attached to was the constitutional phrase, all men are created equal.
That's the Declaration of Independence, right?
that phrase was written by my first cousin, Thomas Jefferson, I think 13 times removed, but he is my first cousin. And he did not mean genetic equality.
No.
He was talking about under the law.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about they should have the same rights under the law. We are created equal by God to be judged in the same way. Believe me, Jefferson, who was a slave owner, would not have been someone who would have been open to these arguments about equality of outcome. He wouldn't have opposed, of course, trying to have the very best education, the most effective education, for everybody, right? No. He wouldn't have stood in the way of that. But that's not what is the political maneuver was attempting to use the phrase for. They were using it in the form of critical theory, which is to say that whatever principle you have as a culture, if the Judeo-Masonic class wants to attack you, they will take the principle and point out that in some areas you're failing and therefore your culture is bad. That never comes to be discussed about, well, there are always conflicting powers inside of any, like political position. And sometimes there has to be compromises between these things for the good of the whole. That's just implicit in all political structures and all political law. But that is not how critical theory works. It just says, women don't get equal pay. Therefore, your culture has to be destroyed. We have we have to rip this apart, and we will find a way to get equal pay. It doesn't matter what the bulldoze does to the family. And that is not really on. We're not discussing that. So,
one asks questions. Why should they have equal pay?
No, and of course, and again,
why should there be more women in science?
Right. What will the effect be when you have women taken away from childbearing?
Well, you have population decline. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, these things are never discussed, and the reason why is because there is malice in back of the proposal.
Also, when you take women away from those roles, they become neurotic and easy to manipulate.
Yeah.
That's what's happened. I mean, here's the practical reality about this deal with integration, and we were told the progress, it was good that blacks and whites were forced together, whatever, even though they didn't want to be, is in Boston. Washington, D.C., public schools, for example, white enrollment was 48% in 1951. Ambitious federal judges ordered racial balancing even before the Supreme Court's Green decision in 1968. So the city learned about integration early. Newly arrived blacks at Theodore Roosevelt High School made so many obscene comments to the girl cheerleaders, the school switched to boys. Several principals decided not to have dances or other social events because the lewd advances by blacks. Whites abandoned the public schools, and by 1974, white enrollment was down to 3.3%. Washington was the first major urban school district from which whites essentially disappeared in the name of integration. Now, I lived in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s. I went to a Catholic school in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s in grade school. At that time, there was a public school across the street from us. Our attitude was no parent, if he could, would send their white kids to D.C. public school at that time.
And they would have been crazy to do so.
Yeah.
Because it isn't just educational outcome. It isn't just that the school really can't focus on the needs of the white students, because by their definitions, the white students are succeeding because they're performing above average on these tests. So there's going to be, a diminution of kind of pedagogical effort for the white kid. But it's the behavioral differences. It's the violence. It's the inner city was highly over sexualized.
Yes.
Remember, this is going on at the same time they're trying to integrate the schools. They're destroying the inner city culture. They're destroying African American culture deliberately.
What was going on there was with black lewdness was the fear of retribution by blacks had gone away by the late 1960s. Meaning there weren't going to be any white. If a white girl gets raped by a black guy, there wasn't going to be a white riot.
Yeah, they get they're being encouraged to commit violence. If you look at like Hollywood, like a Quentin Tarantino movie, I mean, look at how many white people are killed by black people, and Tarantino says, well, it's cathartic, whatever he means by that. But this is just sophistry. He's just part of the Judeo-Masonic project to promote violence, because this will promote the chaos that they want. Mm-hmm. They want force integration, create a completely violent, chaotic clump of humanity, which needs strong governance, which they will, of course, rise up and become. And so, you won't see them. It'll just be their puppets. They're fake mayors and, the fake governors and the people that they just control like robots. That's who you'll see. But the purpose is malevolence. The purpose is to create, you know, a weakened citizenry that will not be able to resist this process we're in the midst of, where they're trying to basically set up world control, you know, world governance, and then of course just depopulate the groups they don't like.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, the so basically what it's been called, what like the post Civil War Constitution is an anti-racist constitution. This makes race the most, you know, the biggest issue with the Constitution.
Yeah.
And so you do have a situation now, again, where you kind of alluded to it, is you have the reality, you do have inequality and differences between the races. Again, there is no general guarantee of equality. Again, the idea of all men are created equal in the Declaration of Independence and how it's substantiated in the Constitution, particularly the Due Process Clause, Equal Protection Clause, and also the 14th Amendment, was that basically in our interactions with the government, due process, whether you're dealing with regulations or if you're brought before the criminal justice system, you have due process. It wasn't a general claim of equality. Again, that was subsequently abused with the courts with substantive due process. This became a pretext for judicial activism, other, you know, other efforts of social engineering, particularly busing and these things, forced busing and integration of these neighborhoods, destruction of these neighborhoods and housing laws, and, you know, the inability for whites to protect them, ethnic whites to group together, protect them, particularly the inability to have restrictive covenants and maintain communities. Now you have HOAs and other ways to try to go about doing it. But, you know, I think it was Shelley versus Parker, which, you know, again, that was because although it's a private contract requires the courts to enforce it. So it's state action. Therefore, the courts would not enforce restrictive covenants to maintain a ethnic balance in the neighborhood, even though that may affect the quality of life in that neighborhood, the identity of that neighborhood, that community. That's simply considered illegitimate evil relative to Brown versus Board of Education, which treats integration as a fetish. It's a moral good, and anything opposed to that is a moral evil, despite all the interests that you articulated or explained, meaning all types of cultural, ethnic, religious, intellectual reasons why you want to exercise in-group preference just to promote your own interest. Good example would have been Catholic ethnics in the 1950s and 60s, having neighbors able to flex their political muscle legislatively to protect their interest in the country's interest as they saw it. When they lost their identity and were dispersed to the suburbs, they lost that ethnic identity and therefore their political power. That's why the Ford Foundation, that's why the Jews and the were for it in the 1950s and 60s to smash ethnic identity, because they saw it as a threat to, you know, the waning WASP leadership. But then as the Jewish ascendancy came to the fore in the 1960s and 70s, it took on a different, I guess, color, if you will. But the idea is there, again, you're gonna have in a free society, you're going to have many examples of inequality that the system is going to have to tolerate and accept and respect and realize this is just a natural course of things. But the presumption of equality that's implied in Brown versus Education and the subsequent Civil Rights Acts that were passed, it simply doesn't comport with reality. So it, by necessity, it creates things like affirmative action, busing, racial quotas, diversity, equity, inclusion, and these things. And the anti-racist constitution became an anti-white constitution. This was difficult because it was ethnic whites who founded the country. And you know, they found themselves, their country being taken away from them for the interest of so-called minority rights. At the same time, standards weren't being upheld immediately. Even neutral standards like high school graduation or tests were declared racially discriminatory because it had a disparate impact. This is, I think, Duke versus Griggs Power Company, 1971. They had a test that disproportionately blacks scored poorer on, and this was ruled unconstitutional because it had outcomes that they didn't like. Just like with families when they had free choice in schooling, initially with Brown versus Education, it said, well, families could freely choose where to live and therefore where to send their kids to school, only so long as they integrated. So, yeah. Only so long as they did what we wanted them to do. Well, that's not free choice. That's social engineering. You're talking both sides of your mouth there. I mean, it's obvious.
Yeah. You know, I was, when you were talking, I was, what brought to my mind was John Stewart's, Tucker Carlson was in St. Petersburg in Moscow, and he's going, God, these cities are so beautiful. They're just, look at these, the culture, the art, you know, the fountains, everything is clean and neat and beautiful. Why can't we have nice things in America? And then John Stuart, in response to that, said, well, this is the price of freedom, right? So crime and graffiti and violence, this is okay. So it's the price of freedom. However,
the price of freedom is being pushed in front of an oncoming subway train by lunatic.
But anyway, what is funny is that you just described the rationale where freedom is actually legally restricted. Mm-hmm. Because if they permit the, you know, parents to do what they want, be free, then they will segregate, right? So there, freedom is prohibited.
Well, here's the thing. Little Rock, Arkansas. Was it the high school Little Rock, Arkansas, where the 82nd Airborne Board came in?
Yeah.
And was sticking bayonets in the direction of white people to integrate the school. This is freedom.
Right. Right. But see, this is the thing. Well, but that's the price of freedom, is that we don't have freedom. Yeah, so, you know, we're just constantly under attack. You know, they have a lot of videos now. They record the violence, typically black on white, you know, school kids or just youths in the street. Mm-hmm. And you wonder what is going to be the long-term effect of all of this. I have maintained, you know, since like before the COVID thing, that we needed to resegregate, that this would be in everyone's interest.
But people will have left to their own device.
And I just think that, you know, kind of the exposure of the actual reality of the integrated world that they've created is now too vivid to ignore. The principles upon that it was based, you know, like genetic equality in 99% are now no longer.
Between certain groups, there's going to be some. Good example. It depends on what you might integrate. I mean, there was a time it was ethnic. Like, it was perfectly natural for ethnic Germans and ethnic Irish and ethnic Italians to integrate because they are different ethnicities. They're all ethnic whites, but they're all Catholic. So their ethnicity mixed. So in America, that they were eventually going to mix together. Same way that if you talk about the cognitive similarities between Asians, East Asians, and ethnic whites in America, that you can, if left alone, they come, for whatever reason, they end up in America because their great-grandparents were coolies or because of the Vietnam War. Again, a lot of the mixing is a product of war, which is social engineering. But anyway, it's a consequence of war. But even then, there's going to be a mixing there where some groups are going to naturally get along better because of the cognitive differences are different. The cultural cognitive aren't as wide, and they're going to get along better. Some groups won't get along together. So if you make a broad-based fetish out of integration among all groups, you're not dealing with the reality. There's going to be some natural integration because they get along. Some groups won't get along. So not all integration is equal. And also based on the terms of that integration. Is based on free choice to a certain extent. I mean, there's always some hidden coercion or some indirect thing that causes people to mix. A good example would be like a natural disaster, an earthquake or something like that, where people move and they end up close to one another. Things like that. There's always some outside direct choice, people choosing. There's always something that's just making them choose a certain path or something. But my point being is that the difference is there. So there's my point is that there's some level of integration is going to occur. But historically speaking, segregation has involved a lot less coercion and social engineering than integration, because integration requires social engineering, which is force. So based on liberal principles, it's wrong. But then again, there's a lot of inherent contradictions in liberalism. You know,
I just wanted to say that I would like to go macro. You were giving really good examples like religion, like the Catholic European religion. So these cultures can easily integrate. You know, they have all this shared. I mean, they could all speak the Latin Mass at one time, you know, example.
Like a lot of German, Irish, and Americans. Yeah, a lot of Irish.
The Europeans and Asians, in the macro sense, going macro, they are the descendants of Neanderthal.
Yeah.
They all share this Neanderthal genetic heritage, which in many cases are brain active genes. So mm-hmm. they have that as kind of a common basis for, you know, culture. Whereas sub-Saharan Africans they have the genes from Homo erectus, which do not occur in the macro sense in the north. And so it is very possible, and believe me, these things, and one of the reasons why we don't know these things is because people don't want to look. they're afraid what they're going to find, so the science doesn't move in these directions.
Well, wasn't sociology corrupted long ago in this area, like with Boaz and even guy Gould, what's his name?
Jay Gould?
Yeah, he corrupted his studies because of his.
Sure. Yeah, I know. I just lied his head off.
Yeah.
But the thing is that they wanted to create the fantasy of intellectual equality across all of the ethnicities, which of course is parallel to the fantasy in Hollywood, wherein you have constant replications and creations of cognitively superior black people.
Yeah,
you have a group of people, and the physicist is the black guy. This theme just occurs over and over again. With now, the idea here is that through these images, that the self-esteem will be raised, and eventually you're going to, because of that.
Yeah,
since environment was the only basis for distinction, you will end up with, through the self-esteem, insertion, you'll end up with equality of outcome. Well, of course, we've seen this now over, 70 years, and it's just been a complete disaster. And yet the dream world exists. It exists more vividly now than ever. In Hollywood, it is just a norm for both violence against whites, which is not common in our culture. It's the other way around. And also academic superiority by blacks, which again works in Hollywood movies, but you don't see a lot of that inside, the actual on the street American culture.
No, not when to boost, black doctors, they have to do it with the MCAT test.
Yeah. Well, for example. And so, so here, you have the original intellectual error, which was the idea that we're all created equal and environment is the rules, the outcomes. We have no way at this point to actually backstep to have the necessary social discussion as to, well, okay, folks, we're really not genetically equal.
So accept the reality of differences in inequality.
But also the discussion of what to do, because I am completely convinced that that these issues could be resolved if we're honest. For example, it's even possible to imagine gene therapy if, like, one group has something that is, like, really useful.
But doesn't one group have an advantage? Given the fact that they have lower cognitive skills, they have more powers of intuitive and also, say...
Exactly. See, the thing is...
Then you're playing God. My point is they're more athletic. Or they're better at jazz music.
We can't talk honestly about any of this. And so what's going to end up is we're just going to make everything worse. Everything will be worse. Violence will be worse. The brain power will be worse because there is malice in the production of the integration. You better believe that there is going to be absurdity in the outcome. None of the goals will be reached, which of course everyone should see now. Yeah. I mean, it's obvious. The inner city, after 70 years of great society programs, is in a complete freefall.
Look, a blacks may not be as good at standardized testing as East Asians. But they're better at improvisation.
Exactly.
So to be good at improvisation, it has its own social value. Arguably, you're going to do away with it. So then it's a value judgment. But the point is, you have to deal with the reality. There's going to be inequality. That inequality can be complementary and necessary. Your example is the inequality between men and women. It's a necessary difference. It's a complementary difference.
You can't even do pedagogy that's coherent. If you're going to drink, it's all just going to use everything.
Well, basically, you're dealing with the false promises of the American dream, which is everyone being equal. Then if you're dealing with a false promise, you're always going to be disappointed, but that's a good example of this whole the dishonesty of it all is with Brown versus Board of Education. Getting back to it, it was bad law. Everyone admitted it was sociology, but nevertheless, all the judges being appointed to the judiciary at Supreme Court had to swear an oath to it. And the good example is Rhett Rehnquist, when he was appointed to the Supreme Court with Nixon in 1971. He had written up, I think as a law clerk in the 50s, as many law clerks had written against it as bad law. He had to recant or repudiate that during the hearings in the Senate, confirmation hearings. So he's being dishonest. He's lying. He said that it was sound law, settled law, and he respected, what was his quote? Despite... trashing it in the 1950s with good legal reasoning, This is when he's being appointed. Yeah, to clarify any ambiguity, Rehnquist pledged his personal fidelity to Brown, and in the, he had written a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee clarifying his views, or just restating his views, or actually repudiating his past views, which were sound, and just playing, you know, basically worshiping at the totem of Brown. And he said he had to write a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee to in order to get confirmed. And he, so he wrote a letter following proclamation. I wish to state unequivocally that I fully support the legal reasoning and the rightness from the standpoint of the fundamental fairness of the Brown decision. Fundamental fairness. First of all, there is no legal reasoning in Brown. So how can he agree with it or
Right.
disagree?
Where is he going to find it?
It was all about being fairness, you know,
Yeah.
fairness. So again, this is fun. So we have a society, even the highest level of the courts, is fundamentally dishonest to these things. It's
Yeah.
fundamentally dishonest. So
Yeah.
when you're fundamentally dishonest about this, you're not dealing with the reality, you're going to be, as we found out in 2020, with all the Black Lives Matter stuff and all this, no progress had been made. In fact, it has gotten worse because the sense of entitlement agitation is worse. And so no one's ever going to be happier because you're not dealing with reality at this point. And so you
Right.
can't
And you
move
know
on.
what I would like to see, Tim, is a legal action brought to the Supreme Court for demanding representation of Homo erectus. And I know this sounds comical, but I think it actually would be very, I mean, again, the question is how do we have this discussion socially? Because it's just impossible under the current racial, you know, kind of hypersensitivity. But the fact is, someone should bring the, say, look, we Homo erectus is 10% of the genetic material of African Americans, of the Americans who came here from Africa. And nowhere are our unique skills and deficiencies represented in law. That we are literally we are enforced into a kind of non-existence, even though we make up so much of the genetic material. And we want representation. We want disclosure of who we are, what we are, what is discrimination against us, and what will promote us? What do we, what where what do we need help with? What would we, what would is are there any kind of genetic therapies that might help us with our weaknesses and perhaps skills and things that we have which we can promote in other groups that could benefit them? Because there is no honest discussion. I mean, just think of how profound, I mean, you know, like Neanderthal gets all good, great, you know, that he's like on TV just constantly now. You got Neanderthal like sitcoms, you know, and they're just everywhere. But Homo erectus gets, because he was archaic purportedly, you know, he gets no representation, you know, and the reason is because they, if the discussion goes forward, it will just point out how differences the different races are genetically, but they need representation. I mean, I know this concept is like it's so left field. People will not have, they won't
Well,
understand this,
it's
but
almost,
they
I mean, it's.
need representation because this, if, without an honest discussion of what it is, what makes up this genetic material, what weaknesses and what strengths it brings, you can't design social programs coherently. You can't design pedagogy. I mean, this is ridiculous. Where is the representation of Homo erectus, now that we have discovered him within us, with among us, in our genetic material? We need to know about this individual. They only refer to him. It's really very, you know, kind of derogatory. How they describe this in like science papers is they call him the ghost species. That's they say. Well, he's the ghost. They, literally, this is how they. You Google it, you'll see that this is the ghost species. But if you then go forward and say, well, who might the ghost species be? It'll always come to the same thing. Well, it's got to be Homo erectus. But they don't use Homo erectus. They'll use the term ghost species. So I'm saying we got to have this as a public, really highly vetted and just open discussion. Everyone needs to participate in this. Everyone, because we're all, they're forcing us into this you know, race mixed clump. What's going to occur out of that? Well, we got to know that. We have to know what, you know, the nature of the genetic material is we're dealing with. So Homo erectus, there should be like maybe the ACLU will take this on. They should like bring a case to the Supreme Court saying we want, we demand representation. This individual, this species, this human power is within us, and yet it gets nothing. We don't hear about it. We don't see about it. and we don't do anything to help it. So I would love to see that case brought to the Supreme Court.
Well, here we have a situation, I've talked about this before, is outside the African American Museum, Smithsonian Institute, they had a plaque that listed attributes of whiteness or white supremacy. And they listed things like punctuality, politeness, exactitude, perfectionism, these things. Well, these things are the foundation necessary for a modern complex society to function. And if you're saying you can't live up to these things, or things are uniquely to ethnic white people, and therefore, so I guess presumably they're not common among Black people, then you're going to have to some form of segregation or inequality to maintain a sense of standards or community, because they're saying they're outside they're saying that they're different. If you're different, then there's an argument for segregation. They're inherently different. They admitted that. That's outside the African American National Museum. They admitted that. Okay. Well said, what you're admitting is you're relative to white people. You're primitive. You're saying that, and this is all part of our shuck and jive culture.
These are terms which are, I mean, you know, can easily be applied, but not necessarily precise, because what you're really dealing with is different genetic combinations. And believe me, this is very, very complex. I mean, this is not like you can't.
It is.
Say
so basically, it,
but one thing you can't say, you cannot say, is that we have enough equality to have, similarity of pedagogy, and that we can.
Well, waving the magic wand isn't going to solve the problem.
It does. See, this is the thing. The judge thinks he's done something to solve the problem. The judge didn't even know what the problem was.
No, well, because the presumption was
in 1950, when this thing was, when they were designing this stuff, they didn't know about the ghost species. They had no idea. It was actually only like 10 years ago they started realizing they had to. I won't go into the math, but they had to start postulating a distinct species, because you started getting things like the saliva gene was more similar to Neanderthal among the Europeans than it was to the Africans as well.
Well, also the presumption that hundreds of years of custom and laws to separate and regulate relations between the various races or ethnic groups was all bad, and therefore didn't deserve any scrutiny or analysis, just needed to be wiped away in the name of progress, was stupid. It's reckless.
It's like the family was so terrible. Yes. We had to get rid of the family.
Well, it's the same thing. Okay, so you have these differences.
We never talk critical theory, brother. They never talk about what is positive. They just focus on
what is negative, and which is you pathologize it all. Another thing is, it's similar with the basically the logic of civil rights regarding Blacks was applied to like sexual politics and feminism and this, and the protests in the streets, the demands, all that, the laws. You know, women are up the, are lower tier, but they're also protected class, presumed victims too, which is dubious in and of itself, when actually they're privileged in many respects. That's how you look at it, actually. But the idea is that sexism is bad. Well, what's sexism? Sexism is the the distinction of treating women, people differently when basically it's the treating men and women differently when sex doesn't matter. Okay, when doesn't sex matter?
It's so
you should ask yourself that. It's such a. I mean, when doesn't it matter? It matters profoundly. And when you do things like, well, in the name of equality, we need to boost women's employment or participation in science and credentialism and getting these things, there's a profound cost, because you're asking women between ages of 18 to 30 to sacrifice their most fertile years. And these are the years when they can attract a mate and have a family, which is the foundation of society. So you're undermining society, and of course, it's like telling women having a cigarette will liberate you, baby. Have a degree will liberate you, baby. No, it won't. Yeah, you're sacrificing your most precious years for nothing.
You get a
useless degree anyway. A degree, and by the way, it's not like they're neutral getting a degree. They're being indoctrinated and ruined in the process. So the outcome, the end of the academic process, you have a neurotic, guilt-ridden, barren woman. Okay, and that's a threat to society.
And that was the point of it. That was exactly what they wanted to create. And the people who were in the process were too stupid. And I don't mean that that they were genetically stupid. They're just too bamboozled to know any better. And they thought that this was sex, drugs, and rock and roll given to my generation, that this was somehow beneficial.
Well, listen, if men and women are equal,
and forget about building wealth, forget about having a family. Well, actually, the family and wealth and just a stable life ends up being so much more enjoyable. And the other side, what they gave you, led into this you know, the misery of like,
well, all the I guess you could say the respected opinions on issues like feminism are all feminist. Well, that's a conflict of interest. They're
not, well, I mean, you're going to get like, a lot of wide difference of opinion on there.
Listen, if equality requires mountains of dead babies, infanticide, i.e. abortion or contraception, then obviously they're not equal. You're just covering it up with chemical sterilization and infanticide, dead babies. Don't look over there. We're equal. No, you're not, because there's a mountain of dead babies over there to maintain the illusion of equality.
Yeah, notice abortion is no longer a hot button because, for one reason, the statistical reality, which was kept out of the argument when it was a fundraising phenomena, mm-hmm. For the Democrats, is now in the open. I mean, like, they had, after Roe, they had 97% of the numbers of abortion they had in the prior period, 97%. And it was guessed at an increase in chemical abortions, right, mm-hmm. which are of perhaps around 3%. So you had almost no difference, which is what when Roe was on the block, you and I were having discussions. Mm-hmm. We agreed it wasn't going to change anything statistically. No. It was always done as a symbolic issue to bamboozle women into basically not participating in families, mm-hmm. which was very successful. And we now have we're collapsing in terms of family production. And, you know, I've said before, the good thing about this, there is a silver lining in that sad one, but the more you embrace the woke political consciousness, the less likely you are to produce children. And this mm-hmm. is just mechanically true, which means that the political movement only has one generation, which is a good definition of an insane political movement.
And yes.
If you have one generation, it's so bad that it can only produce a single generation. Well, there you go. You know you're dealing with
If your political ideology leads to your extinction, it's not a good idea.
Right. I mean, there it is. There's your payoff for your woke consciousness. So it can't last. It's too stupid. But on the other side, I've seen statistics showing that Christian-oriented families, family production and children production is slightly up.
Yes.
So that these two phenomena will eventually create will restore sanity, because the woke consciousness will become extinct, and the people who have the wherewithal to have families and children, though, they go on and then they create politics. But we have to remember this assault, even if all of the woke individuals pass into extinction, you know, and within 10 years, it isn't enough that they're gone. We have to remember how they were created. Mm-hmm. We have to remember that it was deliberately created. When you go into the inner cities, when you drive, we see the videos of the streets of Cleveland, Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Washington, see the fentanyl brigade, see all of the absolute destruction of human culture. You have to remember, this was designed. This did not occur accidentally. This was designed, and the public needs to understand that. We need to, just like we have to understand Homo erectus and we have to understand Neanderthal. I mean, I know these things are complicated, but by God, we have to understand them, Tim. Otherwise, we will not know the nature of the attack that has come to us, right, is being made to us.
Yeah, someone said to me, all men are created equal. Was it really? Have you been to a mall lately?
Yeah, right. No, and the answer to that is no, it's too dangerous.
I mean,
look at the mall in San Francisco. It's literally deserted.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like 20 years ago, it was just absolutely vibrant and, it was a treasure of San Francisco. Now it's gone.
Yep.
Zero. And it's going to get worse. You'll see San Francisco, once these collapses happen, at the very bottom, they'll be there to buy everything at pennies on the dollar and probably, you know, restart a city. But the other thing, is kind of interesting and needs exposure is these tent cities that they're creating all throughout the United States. In New York, they've had a lot of drone footage of the one there. They've got like 30, 40,000 of the immigrants that they've flown in, and they're just sitting there in these gigantic tents. Have you seen videos of this?
Mm-hmm.
I send you if you want to see them, but So people are doing drone overflights, and some guys have actually gone inside and shown, look, these are all Latino and Black immigrants, you know, in here, yep. Very few whites, and almost all males. Well, what are they for? What is the purpose of the government to bring in, you know, millions of these individuals? I mean, they're obviously not there for employment.
But it's the price you pay for freedom.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, when those people get loose on the streets, I mean, the only way they can survive, there's two ways. There's government largesse, right, which is what they have now. They're just kept as pets by the government. Well, if that stops, what do? It's crime. That's all you got. I mean, so this is what's being set up right now in America, right, is criminality on a scale, well, violence on a scale that is, I mean, I don't think it's ever, other than in warfare, it's never been seen inside of European cities. So this is what we're facing, you know, and where is the media coverage of any of this? You know, so this is one of the reasons why, you know, that there is something really bad being created here, because it's blacked out to, except for the independent media. So
yep. It's not being talked.
Integration is that will be the last step in the process.
Yeah, and opposing that immigration, it was also interpreted in the lens of Brown verification, where it's racist.
Right? Yeah.
So, okay, Joe.
Jim, thank you for the discussion. We'll talk again next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, buddy.